You're good to go.
Avant Garde, everyone. This is Professor Amon Ra, Professor Emeritus, California State University of Long Beach, along with our co-host, Brother Joe Hembrick, a longtime historian, educated out of Compton Unified School District and Linwood Unified School District for over 30-some years, as well as one of the first Black head coaches and longtime historian, as I said. We want to welcome all of you to this show this evening. It should be one of the best that we've had because we're going to feature a historical person, an individual that has become a model to emulate with regards to his struggle. Malcolm said, wherever Black people are, it's a battleground. And that includes those in captivity. We want to thank all those brothers that were in captivity, that kept the faith and organized, helped other young brothers, as well as created organizations for protection and to further our struggle and to straighten out the prisons with regards to their treatment of Black people. And we have, as I said, one of our special guests, an individual that was part of what we call the creators and organizers and developers of the Black August movement, resistance movement, where they honor martyrs, not just those that are part of our historical movements where, with regards to the Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and others that made their sacrifice, but those that were in captivity, that went through transformation from various lifestyles to leaders and organizers, such as like Malcolm. So we welcome Brother G2 Siddiqui, and he's going to give you some highlights of why we should celebrate and honor the month of August, as well as raise some critical issues about the role of Black people, not only in captivity, but on the streets with regards to reorganizing and refocusing ourselves on the movement. So again, I'm just honored to have this brother on our show, the Conscious Corner, along with, as I said, our co-host, Joe Hembrick, longtime historian, because we've been looking forward to this. Every year, we talk about Black August, but we didn't have a person that's helped start it and work with the brothers that were a part of that movement. And it's a very national movement now. People are celebrating and honoring our martyrs and heroes and heroines during the month of August because of all the historical events that took place in August. So without further delay, we're going to have Brother J2 Siddiqui come in and talk about the movement and the programs that we got going. Brother Siddiqui.
Thank you, brother. I'm really honored to be part of this program this evening and to share some of the historical information associated with it. Two things I'd like to do at the beginning is first, not correct, but inform you in terms of practice. When you mention the word celebrate, it's a word that we don't relate to as it relates to this particular activity. It's not a celebration. It's a commemoration. It's a solemn occasion for those that paid the ultimate sacrifice and those behind enemy lines and continue to pay the sacrifice for their commitment. So we understand that there are times when we celebrate certain things, but this is one in which we commemorate the loss of those lives. The other thing, Black August has went beyond the borders of North America or the United States is commemorated in other countries as well, particularly in Ghana and in Cuba, where we've had Africans from diaspora travel there and have implemented the program there. When we talk about Black August, we're talking about a specific time period as relates to the creation of it within the prison walls. However, the month of August is significant to all African people because of the dates of many things that have occurred during the month of August, which we can point to the inception of chattel slavery first occurred in Jamestown, Virginia in 1619 during the month of August. In our own backyard, we know the Watts Rebellion from 65 took place during the month of August. So we can point to a lot of events and also a lot of people who were significant during that time period. Marcus Garvey, Nat Turner, who were both born in the month of August. So the month of August is significantly representative of a lot of our struggles. As relates to the context within the prison system, we can go back to the early 60s when brothers had to deal with, or are still dealing with it, but they had to deal with racist conditions inside the prison system. And these were mainly brothers who had took Shahada and was practicing Islam faith, and they were the ones that were targeted by administration. They were the ones that was targeted by racist prisoners, and they had to defend themselves within that capacity. And so there's a timeline that shows the progression of all of this leading up to what later became known as Black August. Okay, I thought you had a question. In January of 1970, January 13th to be exact, of 1970, in Soledad, Owen. Brother, if you can pull that picture up, the one that's behind me, so I can share that with people and point to what transpired.
Well, I'm going to just put you on speaker because I didn't receive an email. Well, so you go ahead. When you talk, we can see it real good. There it is.
Okay. Behind me, there's a picture. You really can't see it because it's at the bottom, which is Soledad Owain. On that particular day, or actually prior to that date, prior to January 13th, there was an attempt to, or they were in the process of integrating the whole solitary confinement SHU. And that's where Owain was, that's where people who were in solitary confinement was housed at. I was there myself for a couple of years in the SHU before being transferred to the SHU in Vacaville and San Quentin. But during that particular time, they allowed prisoners to have tier time where you can come out your cell by race and interact with one another. And there were several times that brothers were set up, two brothers were murdered. What they would do is they would let the white boys out for tier time, and mysteriously a gate would open up and of one of the brothers. And either they had to come out and defend themselves, or they would be murdered in their cells. One particular brother, W.L. Nolan, who was known for being pretty good with his hands, had his cell opened up during tier time for the whites, and he came out and he got the best end of it. So when they decided to open up an exercise yard, which is a concrete cage, if you can see the picture on my, This will be my left. On my left is the cage or the exercise yard. Next to the exercise yard is a building behind it, which is a hospital. So when they taunted a lot of the black prisons, you know, we opened up the exercise yard on this particular day. That's San Quentin. It's another one, brother. This one with the barbed wire fence at the top. So you know, they were sent, as brother, you know, they was sending out notices beginning to open up the yard. So of course people were gonna come out to the yard, and they were supposed to be letting them out one race at a time: one black, one white, one Latino, one black, one white, Latino. But what they did was they would let one black out and two or three white boys. So by the time that they got a certain number of prisoners out, they hadn't even completed that process, and a fight started. It was a fight between WAL and this AB. AB is a term that's used for Aryan Brotherhood, which is a racist white gang within the prison system. The fight started. The gun tower guard is not that far. His range, he's pretty close. And he fired two shots. One shot hitting WL, another shot ricocheting and hitting the white boy, but he wasn't shooting at the white boy. WL went down. Two of the brothers that was on the yard with him at the time, Cleveland Edwards and Alvin Miller, went over to WL to assist him, take him over to, there's an entrance from the Owen yard into the hospital. And they wanted to get him to that gate so that he can get medical assistance. When they went over to help him, they were also shot. So they end up shooting all three of those brothers. And then they decided to clear the yard. When they cleared the yard, before they even gave them any assistance, they cleared the yard. Instead of going in there and getting them, taking them over to the gate so they can go directly into the hospital, they brought them back into the institution through the hole, through O-Wang, out to the corridor, down the hall, into the hospital. By that time, all three brothers bled out. There was a grand jury panel, and they found that the shootings were justified. Approximately 2 weeks after they were murdered, a guard was murdered and another unit in Central, Solidaire Central. And three brothers were charged with the killing of that guard. Those three brothers was George Jackson, Leader Drumgo, and John Clichette. They were eventually transferred from Solidaire Prison to San Quentin Prison because of all the notoriety around the case, and they changed the venue. And so they were scheduled to go to court on trial in Marin County. Later that same year, August 7th, Jonathan Jackson, who was the younger brother of George Jackson, decided that he was going to liberate his brother and the rest of the comrades. And he moved into he went into the Marin County Courthouse armed, took over the courtroom, and three brothers were, or seven, actually several other brothers were in the courtroom. Three of them were William Christmas, James McClain, and Rochelle McGee. And he asked any of them if they want to be liberated. Those three agreed of the individuals that were in there. And he was able to give them weapons. They took the judge hostage. They took the DA hostage, a couple of witnesses. And they made it out to a van in the parking lot. The objective was to go to a radio station and announce that George should be freed, as well as they were holding these hostages in exchange for the release of George and his comrades. Unfortunately, the policy with the prison administration and with local police department is that we don't recognize hostages. So they end up, the guards and the local police open up fire on the van, killing Jonathan Jackson, James McClain, William Christmas, and seriously wounding Rochelle McGee. They also killed the judge in the process. That led to another incident that happened August 7, 1970. That led to another incident that happened the following year, August 21st, where they accused George Jackson of smuggling a gun into the adjustment center in San Quentin and taking over the adjustment center. And there was a confrontation took place where two guards and I believe it was three racist prisoners were murdered. And they also killed George Jackson that day, assassinated George Jackson. Six brothers were eventually put on trial for the incident. Those brothers were Willie Tate, who we know as Sunday Ati, David Johnson, who we refer to as G.A.P., Louis Talamantes, who we call Bato, Larry Spain, who they accused of coming out of the Adjustment Center along with George, and Yogi Pinnell, or Hugo Pinnell, who we refer to as Yogi. They were all put on trial for the San Quentin incident, which occurred in August 21st, 1971. They were all, with the exception of Yogi, all the other brothers eventually were pled guilty to a lesser crime, but they all made it home, except for Yogi. Yogi was put into solitary confinement, where he stayed in solitary confinement for 46 years prior to a lawsuit that was filed in 2012 that liberated a lot of people who had been warehoused in SHU for some as long as 40 plus years, Yogi being one of them. In August 1st, 1978, one of the comrades who had been in the hole for quite some time, Jeffrey Katari Gordon, was injured on the yard. He received a head injury, and he was transported to the infirmary in the hospital. And then they eventually brought him out of the hospital and was supposed to transport him to a local hospital where he can receive treatment for his injuries. In talking to his wife, who I had met back in 77, Sukari, I found out that they actually drove him around for a while until he was medically dead before they took him to the hospital. So that occurred August 1st in 1978. The following year, Katari was actually part of the origin of beginning Black August. We had begun to prepare for Black August. He was one of the orchestrators of Black August. And so that following year in 1979, August 7, 1979, we began to commemorate these brothers and sisters who have been part of the movement, who made the ultimate sacrifice within the prisons that following year. So this is our 43rd year of commemorating Black August. And the commemoration consists of, one, rededicating yourself to the struggle. We would practice certain things like fasting during the day on certain days. Those particular days, August 1st, moved January 13th into August, And so we commemorated on August 13th. So August 1st, August 7th, August 13th, and August 21st are known as the Flea Days. And Flea Days is the acronym for First Liberation Expedition Africa. Our objective was to develop into the new man, woman, bring whatever development that we had to the community to participate in the liberation movement for African people and other oppressed people within our communities. We formed an organization called Black August BLC, Black August Organizing Committee initially. And that occurred right after one of the comrades, and I had one of the pictures, I don't know if the brother got the pictures, Shuja, who had been on death row for about 7 years because he was accused of killing a guard in Tracy Prison in 1973. And he was released in 1981 following four trials. And him and other comrades started the BALC, the Black August Organizing Committee in Northern California. And they came under attack. I was released in the spring of 82 and spent a lot of time in Northern California. At the time, there was not a lot going on in LA. So in order to get acclimated to what we were doing, in the community, I spent time in the Bay Area first and then tried to replicate that in LA. And when I came to LA, the efforts weren't as successful. I came under attack by a unit called SSU, Special Security Unit. I was, they raided me twice. The initial time they raided me, I ended up back in prison for violation. And later, some folks in the community, some sisters in the community, started a chapter of Black August Los Angeles in LA. And so I've been rocking with them since 2006, sharing information and continuing our work within the prison movement and also within the community to make people aware of the purpose for Black August. So that's kind of an overview of it. We can get into more details. There's a lot that's occurred. One of the things that we've done is that we have tried to keep Angelenos aware of the struggle during the 60s and the 70s, involving primarily the Panthers, but other people who were involved in the movement. And we do this tour every year. We're doing it on the 27th of August this year, where we go to areas of resistance involving the Panthers and others who engage with, I'll be polite to say police, where many of them were martyred. Our website or our Facebook page, you can go to our Facebook page and access a lot of the digital information that we have about a lot of the activities that have taken place over the years, including the Martyrs Tour. But we're doing a physical Martyrs Tour this year, and we'll be fortunate to have one of the brothers who's actually caught up in an attempt to assassinate them. His brother name is Harold Taylor. Excuse me. He was actually at one of the locations in 1968 when they were ambushed by the police, and over 300 rounds were shot into their car. They survived it because they shot back. They were injured. I believe Harold was shot a couple of times, but they survived it. Other places, brothers were just martyred. They were set up. And this is part of J. Edgar Hoover's COINTELPRO program, where they would attempt to annihilate anybody who claimed to be and the membership of organizations like Black Panther Party, the Black Liberation Army. As we know, they set up our sister, Sada Shakur, and attempted to murder her. And she's been in exile for 43 years. So that's kind of overview of it.
Okay. That's okay. First of all, I want to thank you for that history of Black organs, Brother Siddiqui. We're going to see if there's any questions. One question came to the chat concerning Jijaga. Did you ever get a chance to know him, or Jijaga Pratt? One Dr. Carrie Pratt asked that question.
Yes. When Jijaga was released, prior to him being released, when he was going back to court, I was asked to be part of the security team when he went to court. When we were locked up, we were at different prisons. So most of my time was spent in solitary confinement. He was on the main line in San Quentin at the time. When they transferred me to San Quentin, I was in the SHU program. So we actually were on a panel together when he was released. We both spoke together. We were together at East LA College where we spoke on a panel together. I had opportunity to talk to him once when he decided to relocate while he was in Tanzania. We talked about phone once.
Okay.
And I know two of his relatives. Actually, I know his sister and also two of his cousins, Kwabena Jijaga and his brother. He's a naturopath now. His name is escaping me. I know his last name is Emoji, but I can't remember the brother's first name.
Okay. All right, Carrie, do you have any other questions?
Oh, am I unmuted right now?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. No, it was very interesting listening to you talk. So Geronimo's my uncle and Kwabena's his nephew. So we're brother and sister. And
Tabidi, that's what I was trying to think of.
No, Tabidi's a cousin.
Right.
Kwabena is his nephew. So our dad is his big brother.
Okay.
Geronimo. So yeah, I was wondering, I was listening to your story and some of it sounds like his story. And I didn't know if you guys, so you did cross paths in San Quentin?
No, we didn't cross paths in San Quentin. We actually met on the streets when he was released.
Oh, okay.
We were both on a panel at East LA College together.
Okay. Well, I thank you so much for sharing. I have another question on Black August. I don't know if I can answer that now or I can talk later.
Go ahead.
So I just came back from Martha's Vineyard. I had never gone. I didn't know what it was about. And they call that Black August too. And I know it's totally different, but it's still Black people who come together, sharing, it seems like, networking and that kind of stuff. So is the whole month of August dedicated to Black folk in America and we all have our different areas, or can anybody answer that?
The name Black August has been appropriated, and people who want to relate to it, because of the notoriety of the term now, people have appropriated it. But in a lot of cases, it has nothing to do with the origin of Black August, which is why we try to put it out, because people lost their lives. You got comrades that have been locked up for over 50 years, who, because of their commitment to the tenets and the foundation that Comrade George laid down, they have continued to stay in prison. If you know of the head of the Southern California chapter of the Black Panthers. Excuse me. Sometimes I have these memory lapses. Bunchy Carter, his younger brother, Kenny Carter, has been in prison for 50 years. And they won't release him, not because of the crime that he committed, but because of his political stance. I got several comrades. Michelle McGee has been locked up for 58 years. He's 83 years old. He doesn't represent a threat to anyone, but they refuse to let him go. These are political prisoners who are not necessarily recognized, such as Mutula Shakur or Mumia. But these are brothers who had the same commitment and made the same transformation in their lives as Comrade George. But because of their commitment, they're continuously housed. One brother just, it's a lot of them I'm really close with because we all started in the SHU around the same time in the mid-70s. Another brother just went to the board 2 weeks ago, Yafeu Yapa. And he was denied because he was denied parole because they wanted him to debrief. Debriefing as a result of the lawsuit that was filed in 2012 was outlawed. But it's, you know, a lot of people in the community don't know about these things that happen inside the prisons. You have brothers that they put in the SHU. For myself, it wasn't any crime I committed, but it was because of my commitment that I ended up in the SHU. Once you get in the SHU, the only thing that saved me from still being in prison was that they changed the laws in 1977 from most cases from indeterminate to determinate sentence. And I fell within that category. And so I was able to get out and others weren't. One brother was set up, Yafeu. There was a prison riot and brothers had been attacked by racist white boys and confused Latinos on a couple of occasions. And brothers got the bad end of it. The third time they were prepared when they were attacked, and they were attacked, like one was attacked. One attack took place during Black History Month. Another attack took place during the first Black August event. And in that attack, that riot, two white boys were murdered, and several people were stabbed.
Go ahead, you're back loud.
Okay. And they marched. I was already open in the old way. They marched these brothers around December 79 and marched all over to the whole 19 brothers, Yafeu being one. Two brothers were charged with murders. Other brothers were charged with assaults. Yafeu was the only one that wasn't charged with an assault or a murder, but he was convicted of a conspiracy. And I get emotional when I think about all the stuff. He got convicted. Yafeu was supposed to come home before me. He was scheduled to get out in 1981. He got charged with conspiracy to murder, not kill anyone. They had witnesses that said he wasn't doing anything. They didn't see him attacking anybody. He's a big brother, boisterous, but his heart is just good as gold. And so he was always the one who would be the common factor whenever there was any racial strife. They gave him life in prison. No evidence that he did anything, but they refused to let him go because they wanted him to debrief. Debriefing is a process that they used to use when they had these brothers' warehouse in Pelican Bay, where in order for you to get out the hole, you had to snitch on somebody. You had to give them some information. That process was outlawed after the class action lawsuit, but they still use it. So he was denied parole 2 weeks ago.
Okay. All right. Is that okay? Terry, you okay?
Wow. Yeah, I'm okay. I'm just unbelievable. I'm just in this We need a lot of help. That's all from, we need a lot of help from other people that are in attorneys, black attorneys, especially even other attorneys to help get these brothers out. This is just heartbreaking to hear.
Well,
I heard a lot from my uncle, but this is, something else.
Right. He did close 26, 27 himself. Sister Asada, are you there?
Asada, yes.
Do you have any questions for J2?
No, I don't have any questions. I was just listening in. Thank you.
Okay. Linda, do you have any questions?
No, I don't really have any questions. What I wanted to do is ask G2, you know, what the sister just said, help. Who do you think now? She mentioned attorneys. Who else do you think can help out at this point with some of the brothers that are still in there now?
Anybody that's willing to lend a hand. We've been with the Rochelle McGee Committee. We've been trying to give a lot of exposure to his case. I mean, this man he's essentially been in prison since he was 16. He initially went to prison in Louisiana in 1955, I believe it was, the same year that Emmett Till was murdered. And he was charged with allegedly raping a white woman. This white woman, we've done a lot of research, found this white woman that he supposedly raped was actually somebody he was involved with romantically. And she was a married white woman. And no other blacks were allowed to come in and testify. And he was railroaded at the age of 16. He spent 8 years in Angola state prison, which is actually a former slave plantation before he came to California. He had been in California for 6 months and was involved in an incident where there was a dispute about a $10 bag of weed. And the end result was that he was charged with kidnapping, and there was no kidnapping that took place. He was really vocal about it about being railroaded to the point where they bound and gagged him in court. His attorney, this man's been through, I think it was 6 or 7 presidencies. So at the time, I think this was during the Kennedy administration. Mm-hmm. And he was convicted of simple kidnapping. And he's been fighting to be exonerated of these false charges ever since then. He admits his involvement with Marion County Courthouse takeover, but he references the kidnapping of Africans from the continent, particularly those that took over the slave ship, overwhelmed the crew, took over the slave ship, and attempted to sail back to Africa. And one of those was Sen Q. And so he refers to himself as Sen Q. And he's been fighting, he says, since 1963 to be exonerated of those charges. And as he sees himself as a slave, which I do as well, and he had a right to rebel against those conditions. And so he's not apologetic about it. So anybody that's willing to help, we've gotten a lot of support. We've gotten some support from Shell's case, but you got numerous brothers that should have been home long ago. If they're attorneys, and that's one of the things that they need is attorneys, because most of us don't have the legal skills to help. We're doing what we can. Politicians, anybody that's willing to assist with this. Many people, they were able to finally get out of the shoe, I went up to Sacramento when they were first, when they began to, they had a hunger strike that took place back in 2011 and 2013 because of the conditions in the shoe. Pelican Bay, Guantanamo Bay pales in comparison to the conditions within Pelican Bay, where there was complete isolation, sensory deprivation, and a lot of things that took place to break their spirits. Rather than break their spirits, these brothers formed what they call a think tank and began to interact with one another to maintain their sanity. It wasn't like it was back here where we can go, when we were in the shoe, we could go to the yard, play basketball, have exchanges in our cells. Your cells was next to one another. You could talk to brothers. In Pelican Bay, it's total isolation. You can't talk to anyone. When you go to the exercise yard, it's actually a little concrete area behind your cell. So you're going out there individually. These are the conditions that they had to exist. They opened up Pelican Bay in 1989. So from 1989 until 2015, these brothers really had no interaction, no human contact for that length of time. So anybody that can help.
Okay. Linda, any other questions?
I do. No, not at this time. Oh, she has them.
Okay, I'm sorry. Jutu, is that how you say your name?
Sounds like the letter G and the number two.
Oh, G2. So G2. So do you guys have anybody that's working to help these brothers and sisters get out? Or because the guy you said that's been in there since 1955, how old is he now?
He's 83 years old.
Oh, my God.
He was in prison initially for 8 years. He's been in California prison for the past 58, 59.
San Quentin? Which one?
Right now, he's at Vacaville prison.
Vacaville?
Yes.
That's up in, okay, because I know a lot of the prisons because they move G around a lot.
Right. Yeah, that's wow. Forget the county. I spent time there myself, but it's in Northern California.
So I would like to connect with you when this is over with to get more information, not just for him, but I mean, that's ridiculous. Yeah. I do know a lot of people in Cali that even work on the other side that, you know, I would love to put him in connection with. When my Uncle G, before he got out, I went into Johnny Cochran's office. They accidentally let me in there. And I was like, hey, you know, he didn't expect me. They had a substitute receptionist who told me to come on up. So, and I came on up and I talked to Johnny, and then that's when Johnny finally got on board, you know, and whatever, after he got done with everything else. Mm-hmm. So I like to be able to, I don't know if I personally would do that per se, but I do know a lot of brothers and sisters out there that are, you know, they talk a lot of talk.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in positions, I know a lot of attorneys and doctors and things like that, and they are extremely conscious. I don't know if they know everything that we just heard tonight, but I really would like to connect with you to see how we can really get together and help some of these, because 83 is ridiculous.
Brother G2, pardon me, because I want to say, I just want to let Carrie know, my sister know that Auntie Jenny has had been in conversation. I know she visited Rochelle, Brother Rochelle Cinque McGee years ago. And I'm just glad to hear you say that you're interested in assisting in this because because you did put in a lot of good work in helping to get Uncle G's case, you know, more and more notoriety and during that time right before he got out. So that's good. I'm glad that you said that you want to work on this. And our Brother G2, I know Professor Amaro, I'm sorry, I jumped in right here, but it's ironic, we had Brother G2 on with us and Gary giving us our Black August program. He was our keynote speaker a couple years ago during COVID. So we were, again, brother, we appreciate that. Back then, I'm even learning more tonight from you, man. And I wanted to ask, I mean, I know you want to finish up with Carrie's question, but I also want to ask about those dates again, August 7th.
August 1st, August 7th, August 13th, and August 21st.
Okay, if you can just share what that meant again, too.
Those are the dates where comrades were martyred, and those are dates what we refer to as Flea Days, which stands for First Liberation Expedition Africa. Those days we usually fast for 24 hours. The other dates are similar to Ramadan, where you fast from sun up to sundown. August 1st was the day that just mentioned Comrade's name.
Qatari.
Qatari was Jeffrey Qatari Garden was martyred. August 7th, the man child Jonathan Jackson was martyred. August 13th was when W.L. Nolan, Miller, and Cleveland Edwards were martyred. August 21st was when, August 7th wasn't just Jonathan Jackson. It was also William Christmas and James McClain that were martyred. And August 21st was when the comrade, George Jackson, was martyred.
What about, you're going to mention the martyrs tour?
Yeah, I made reference, for those that don't know, Asada is one of the sisters, one of the comrades that I referred to earlier, who founded Black August Los Angeles. Back in the early 2000s. And she's referring to the Martyrs Tour I spoke about. We don't have a flyer on it yet, but the Martyrs Tour is where we go to areas within Los Angeles and also Compton, where there were periods of or moments of resistance where a lot of brothers and sisters were martyred. We go to 41st and Central, which is where after Fred Hampton and Mark Clark were assassinated in Chicago in 69, which was under the COINTELPRO program, counterintelligence program, under the FBI director, J. Edgar Hoover, they attempted to do the same thing in Los Angeles when they raided the Panthers headquarters. And again, those brothers and sisters they were prepared and they fought back. And in fact, their training because of the comrade Jijaga, Ronald, these brothers and sisters were prepared when the police came in and they returned fire and all of them survived. We go to that location, we go to several different locations outside, within Los Angeles and also Compton. And that'll take place. We'll have the flyers out soon. It will happen August 27th, 2022. We're going to be meeting at the Chukos Justice Center at 7625 Central Avenue, where people will get on the bus and be toured around the city. Because we're in the era of COVID, we ask people to get there early because they'll be required to take a COVID test and must wear a face mask during the tour to ensure all of our safety. This is one of the incidents, this particular, we're showing now Adams Montclair. There used to be a gas station in that corner. And these three brothers right here, Tommy Lewis, Steve Bartholomew, and Robert Lawrence, were assassinated by LAPD. LAPD pulled up in the gas station. before the brothers could even get out the car, they opened fire and killed all three of them. So that's one of the locations that we go to.
All right. Oh, wow, really? Thank you. Asada, did you
don't forget any? There's also going to be a caravan for people who don't want to ride the bus.
Yes, those that don't want to ride the bus, or even if the bus only holds a total of 55 people. And so some people elected to, they wanted to be able to follow the bus. And so they can follow the bus. And we're going to try to set up where we have communication between the bus and or do it on Zoom where people that's following can listen in and participate as well.
Brother Hembrick, are you still there? I don't see you. Brother Rasha Key?
Yeah.
Do you have any questions?
No questions. I'm just listening. Really good information. I'm gonna continue to listen.
Okay. One of the things that I like to share, and I see that my niece is online. One of the comrades who was really close with W.L. Nolan and also with Qatari, Yogi Ugo Pinnell, he would have been on that yard at the time that it happened, because he was one of the ones that administration really wanted to murder, and they weren't successful in doing it. He just happened to be out of court the day that this occurred. But he was one of, he was also one of George's closest comrades. And he was in San Quentin at the time that the incident happened, August 21st. He was one of the ones that was charged with participating in the so-called uprising in ACU in San Quentin. And he was put on trial and he was convicted. He was one of the ones that was convicted of assault. He wasn't convicted of a murder or anything else. He was convicted of assault. He spent 46 years in solitary confinement out of the 51 years of total confinement. And he participated in the hunger strike during 2011 and 2013. And when they freed people from solitary confinement as a result of the successful lawsuit, he came out of solitary confinement after the time period was transferred to Folsom Prison. And he had only been in general population for 2 weeks. He was set up by the guards, ABs and others, and was assassinated at the age of 69. And I'd like my niece to speak to her father, who was Yogi was her father. And if she'd come on and share a few words about Yogi, I'd appreciate it.
Is she there?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm here, but I'm multitasking. He was 71 when they murdered him. Hi, Theo.
Hey, Nisi.
Let me see if I can get working. One for a minute. Sorry, buddy. I'm multitasking out here. The kids collecting their fundraising funds. And Theo, what did you tell me to say, Theo? What happened?
I just want you to share a little bit about your father. And I know we just went to court. And before you do, let me say this. Yogi was assassinated August 12th, 2015. His trial for the San Quentin Six brothers were convicted August 12th, 1976. August 12th, 2012, a lot of the prisoners that were in Pelican Bay signed this agreement that they were supposed to spread to other prisons and also on the streets, agreement to end hostilities. After being confined in SHU for decades, they realized that fighting one another was aiding the administration. And so they came up with this agreement to end hostilities that was supposed to be implemented across the board, across racial lines. That occurred August 12th, 2012. August 12th, 2015 was when he was murdered. And the two of the ABs that were charged with his murder just had a hearing on August 12th, 2022. Mm-hmm. Okay,
oh, goodness. Yeah, they were both in the room. It was my first time being in the room with them, not just on the screen. Of course, we got another postponement, some new evidence, confidential evidence to come forth. We have a black prosecutor, and he's trying to get it to trial. So he knows that it's 7 years too late, but he's trying to push it forward. Next court date, coincidentally, is going to be on January 13th. I just want to say my dad was a class act. My dad was a warrior to the end. I will love and honor him all the days of my life. And for those that didn't know him or perceived him wrong, you really missed out. You missed out on a man that imposed quite a bit of love for community, for the struggle. He stood unbroken for 46 years. And I'm unapologetically proud to say that I'm the daughter of Hugo L.A. Pinnell. Love you, Theo.
Love you too, Nisa.
Okay. Thank you, sister. Okay. I just got a couple questions.
Professor Rob, before you get started, we have Brother Dr. Mashinda Shay Goldston and Sister Make It Happen. They haven't had a chance to ask a question.
All right, why don't you go ahead and call on them?
Okay.
I can't see them. You go ahead.
Okay, Brother Doctor? Question or comment?
Yeah, interesting story. I have a few questions. Talk about one guy that went up to parole board and they denied his parole. And he said because he didn't want to debrief. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, now, so they still believe that the organization, the party, whatever you want to call it, still exists? Because I'm a little familiar with stuff. This has been over 40 years, so what is there to debrief about? Can you kind of explain that? Because I'm missing something.
Well,
what would they think there would be for him to debrief about?
There isn't anything. That's one of the requirements that they had. You know, and some people that couldn't deal with, and rightfully so, I mean, that's a long time to be isolated. And some people broke, and they would make up stuff. It didn't have to be factual. They would just make something up in order to get out of the SHU program. They would make up stuff about other people, say that they were engaged in certain activities in order to get out.
Correct. You know, who's left to tell about that? That's what I don't, because I'm not familiar with most of the cases. So there's a lot of people left that was originally convicted with him that they want him to tell on, basically.
No, right. Not convicted with him. If they have any intel, period. He's selling drugs. He's doing this.
Oh, okay. He's just telling him generally, yeah. Right? On anybody in general.
Right.
Okay. So, go ahead.
So, in this particular case, one, you know, he's not in SHU anymore. He's actually made full circle. He's back at Solitary Prison, where he started back in 1975. But I mean, these are old brothers. I mean, they don't represent a threat to anybody. But because of, you know, like one brother, he's 70 years old. He goes to the board later this month. And they have this process called 7:30, where maybe it's 6:30. I don't recall, because it's something new. This wasn't going on during my time inside. But they have these forms where you could send in a 7:30 or send in a note. He's engaged in this. His brother's 70 years old. He's not doing anything. But many of us were accused of being a part of what they call a prison gang. We refer to as a political organization, the Black Guerrilla Family. And if you were considered to be a member of that organization, then you represented a threat. Everybody that I know has made a transition in lives. I mean, you know, our days consist of reading, studying. When I first came home, I read so much about the struggle on the outside that I was willing to go back to prison to be able to be encircled in that movement. So the Republic of New Africa have this event. They've been doing it since the 70s, where they have, used to call it Black Nation Day. Now it's referred to as African Nation Day. That particular year, after my release, they were scheduled to host it in Detroit. So I know I'm on parole. I'm not going to get permission to travel to Detroit. So I risked the opportunity of getting on a flight, going to Detroit, and be surrounded by people who I'd read about, who I'd studied, and who was part of the Black Liberation Movement. People such as Queen Mother Moore, Robin Williams, who many of you know, him and his wife in the South had to fight Jim Crow and racism. And in fact, brother, I'm sure y'all familiar with Akinyele Moja, who wrote a book, We'll Shoot Back. And he makes reference to people like Robin Williams. So and I'm kind of getting off subject a little bit, but that's what we did. You know, we studied. I mean, prior to coming to prison, I knew nothing about struggle. I knew my brother, who unfortunately was murdered by LAPD in 1985, not accused of any crime. But he used to be a member of the Black Panther Party. And he was, the night that he was murdered, I happened to be with him. He had called me about a situation that was going over in his community, which was off of 45th in Vermont. And he's talking to a group of young people about the police coming to our community, holding our community under siege, and how they need to be informed about stuff they're doing that's going on in the community, so they can be part of the solution as opposed to being part of the problem. Hours after I left him, he was approached by the police. In this case, I'll use the term pigs because it's really emotional for me, and shot 7 times in the back. So, you know, there's nothing that the brothers I know were engaged in other than being immersed in study, immersed in developing ourselves so that we can be an asset to our communities when we came out. And this brother has done, Yafir has done a lot. He's participating a lot, even from prison. And what's ironic is that I went to prison as a result, unfortunately, and I went to prison as a result of an incident where I was attacked by brothers from his neighborhood, and in defending myself, somebody lost their life, and that's what sent me to prison. Me and this brother were supposed to be mortal enemies when I got to prison because of that. I mean, there's very few people that I'm closer with than him today.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know if that answers your question, but it's
not my question. Now, the synthesis. Now we're, so I know the indeterminate determinant. Now were any of these guys sentenced to life without parole?
No.
So everybody has a chance to get parole, right?
They have a chance to get parole. While they were in SHU, there was no chance. A SHU program.
They weren't sentenced to life without parole.
No. They weren't LWOPs. And they were back in the day, it used to be 7-Up. It used to call it first 7-Up.
So with all the laws that passed in the past 4 or 5 years, they were never able to, because I know the governor was kicking out the lifers. They got the lifers program and kicking everybody out, a lot of people out.
Yeah.
They never fell on that list. And this is just my opinion. Is somebody there? This is a personal thing, man. You got a congressman, somebody that something's personal with some of these people, man. It's personal. I don't think it's the crimes. If they got a chance, if they were sent without, you know, with the possibility of parole, you got something that's personal. Because I've personally been on, you know, board hearings where I know the commissioner would give people more time because they did a crime in their neighborhood. I've been personally involved where something happened to a senator's daughter and they called us to go swoop up the parolee. So you got something's going on personal. I don't know whether this is just my opinion. It's something behind the scenes personal, man, that's going on with somebody that's still alive that was back in there that has some power. So this is more of a personal thing. Man, that's my opinion.
It's more political than it is personal. Yeah. When I came home, I came under surveillance by SSU. And when they first raided me and ended up sending me back to prison, prior to the raiding, I came home. My parole officer was an African. And when I walked to his office, he had a picture of Malcolm X on his wall. I'm like, okay, well, he might not be that bad of a person. And I immediately told him, these are my politics. If you're going to lock me up for my politics, you may as well lock me up now. I'm not involved in any criminal activity. I don't use drugs. I don't drink. I don't do none of that stuff. But I do participate in this activity. And that's my right to do that. His position was, as long as you don't commit a crime, I'm not worried about whatever you do. I was assigned to him, and later I was assigned to another parole officer. And I didn't know at the time that his job was to monitor certain prisoners. And when I went to see him, he said, well, several things you need to do. You need to sign this document saying that if you have any association or affiliation with anybody who's a member of the Black Riddle family, that's a violation of your parole. I'm like, I'm not signing that. So I give you broad discretion to say whoever you want to say is a member as pretext to violate. Then he told me, I need you to test for drugs. I said, for what? I don't have a drug case. He said, well, your former parole officer said that he felt you need to be tested. I said, show me where he said that. Now, it's not that I'm trying to hide. I don't use drugs. But it was the principle of it. So he started flipping through the pages, and then he slammed the book down. He said, I got to show you a GD thing. Whatever I said you do, you do. I said, man, F you. I ain't doing nothing. So he said, well, I'll lock you back up. So I'm like, F it, lock me up. But then I thought about it. I'm like, I'm not trying to hide anything. It's just that I didn't want to be subjected to that. So I went ahead and did what he wanted and tested, but he was actually setting me up. They had members of the SSU in the office, and when I left there, they began to follow me. The first time, I wasn't aware of it, they followed me from my job. They followed me when I was working at a body shop there, and I went to give a customer estimate. They had all this documentation, I'll find out later, but they had me under surveillance. Then they followed me to my house, and I paroled my parents' house, but I actually had my own place. and that's when they raided me. And they arrested me. It was a brother that was down here with his wife and children, and I let them stay in my place. He was arrested, and they would charge me with maintaining clandestine residence, a number of things. But all this was a pretext to get me locked back up. And that's one of the things that they do. Inside prison, during a certain time period, if a brother had a book on something as innocuous as Martin Luther King, he could go to he would be placed in solitary confinement, not knowing why he was there, simply because he had this book. And now the books you could order through the prison process. Once you got the book in your possession and they did a cell search and found it, then they would lock people up. So it's not personal. It was really an effort. It's political. It's an effort to suppress the movement inside. They're still angry, and they'll be angry forever about Comrade George, about anybody that wanted to be conscious, anybody that took the time to understand what this capitalist system represents and suppress that, you know. So it's not personal in that sense.
We got about six more people want to ask you a question. Let's give them one question apiece and then try to, get the answer as short as we can.
Okay.
We're getting a little later. So, Rasha Key, who's next?
Shay Gostin.
Shay Gostin. No, I'm fine. Oh. That's my brother, G2.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
All right, G2. Brother Machenda?
No, I'm good. I'm just taking it all in. You know, I salute the brother and all the other brothers. Regarding Black August, I just thank you for your presentation. I'm going to continue to do my own research.
All right, thanks. So I think Brother Hembrick should be back.
Is he?
Well, I know there he is.
Yeah, brother, appreciate your presentation. I'm just amazed as to, what you just said, about somebody getting a book, trying to raise their conscious level and they move on that. So I hope the listeners can understand how powerful that can be when we move more towards, knowing thyself, compared to what we've learned, since we've been here, in this land of North America. So just appreciating what you said. And it's a shame that, a lot of folks don't develop a level of consciousness, without being locked up. It's a shame. So that lets me know that I need to keep on doing what I'm doing, which I've been doing for about 30 years, trying to wake up the walking dead. So just want to say I appreciate you and I appreciate your words this evening.
Thank you, brother.
Okay. Bob and I.
I had a question and an observation. I remember when Brother G2 spoke again at our Black August program here in Gary a couple of years ago, and we were struggling. One of the sisters from our group, Black Lives Matter, UAM, had put celebrating Black August. And then thinking about that, and then we said, no, we're just recognizing it's really not much to celebrate. But then in listening to the program here on August 1st, Professor Amin-Ra talked about celebrating those in the struggle. And I thought about it. I'm thinking about celebrating Field Marshal George Jackson's Brother Miller, Brother Kahari, Jonathan Jackson, and so many others. And today is the birthday of Conrad Worrell, who was in charge of the National Black United Front for quite a while and would write about political prisoners and things like that. And just thinking about expansion, keeping the emphasis on, of course, our political prisoners and the struggles there, but the expansion of Black August, not so much going into like a Martha's Vineyard type thing that we do there, but just in terms of our liberation struggle and things like that. And you just want to hear your thoughts on that and how you felt about that, Brother G2, and your thoughts on that.
I'm going to try to make reference to it. It's something that I put together a few years ago. I was asked by Malik Abdullah with Black Lives Matter Los Angeles or Black August Grassroots to put something together to speak to that. And I'm going to pull it up. Hopefully I can pull it up real quickly. I just closed out earlier. Okay, this is a collective statement that I put together a few years ago. The month of August is historically abundant in epic moments of African strife, conflict, accomplishments, and resistance. As such, its importance should be embraced, acknowledged, documented, and shared across the globe. Those who respect, admire, and practice the tradition of Black August should embrace the core purpose of its creation, to honor fallen comrades within California's gulags and rededicate our commitment to African liberation established and consummated by the Black August Resistance Collective. We support the inclusion and promotion of all significant and noteworthy African historical events occurring during the month of August as part of the Black August legacy. Ownership of this legacy belongs to African people, but with that ownership comes the responsibility to maintain the integrity of the sacred tenets of its origin and the connection to those who created it, and understanding the political development of the cadre behind the walls into the new man has come at the cost of their freedom and lost lives. Black August, beyond the primary purpose for development, is a time for reflection on past, present, and future struggles for the liberation of African people in solidarity with other righteous struggles of oppressed people across the globe. It is not a celebration or a celebration. As recently embraced, popularized, and encapsulated by Black Lives Matter LA, fast, study, train, and fight is part of the core practice. Maintaining a personal journey to document your daily activities will help you gauge your capacity to endure the most arduous part of the practice and strengthen your determination to be successful and disciplined. And that's from the Black August Collective. So hopefully that webinar is an answer to your question about what I think about it.
Right on. Yeah, I would like to get a copy of that too, if there's some kind of way.
Okay, most definitely.
Okay, right on.
Professor King, anybody else?
That's it, Professor Ra.
All right, I just have a few questions. First of all, let me thank Sister Linda Shorter for encouraging us to get G2 on, Siddiqui on the program. She's helped us with a number of guest speakers, and we really want to thank Linda for communicating a relevancy and the importance of having G2 on. She was right. He has a wealth of knowledge and just information that we all need to help spread and hopefully get involved in trying to feel, as Carrie Pratt said, trying to help some of these political prisoners that don't nobody know anything about. Maybe we can, try to start writing books about it or just move it. And secondly, I want to say I stand corrected. It is a commemoration and recognition of our martyrs and not a celebration from the standpoint of festivity of eating chitlins or, something like that. Shooting off fireworks, it is a commemoration of fallen soldiers, and at the same time, major events like the Watts Festival, they didn't have it this year. They just had a meeting at the coffee house because Sister Pam Garrett is retiring, And I think the Watts Festival Committee is going to pick it back up next year. The other thing is, there are so many things, as J2 said, about that goes on. J2, on the tour, who is going to, will there be stops and people giving an education where they are and what happened? And who would be doing that on the tour?
The tour is headed up by Harold Welton, who's a member of Black Hawk Los Angeles. And this particular year, one of the previous years, Harold Taylor, who was actually one of the people that was involved in the shootout that occurred on 66 and Hooper Avenue across the street from a junior high school, or on the street where the junior high school is. This is where Harold and two of his comrades were stopped by the LAPD, and I believe the FBI was involved in it also. And they stopped them, and before he knew it, they opened up on him, and they returned fire. So all three of the brothers survived the attempt to assassinate them. He'll be on the tour, and he'll be talking about that. There's one thing for us to go and talk about what transpired. It's another to have someone who's actually there to give us an example of it. In the past, we've had Wayne Farr to participate. He's now an ancestor. Roland Freeman, who's now an ancestor. These were members of the Black Panther Party, and those two in particular were in the building on 41st and Central, the Panthers headquarters, when their headquarters came under assault. So in the past, we've had them to share. But those will be the two primary people talking about what occurs at each location. Because of the time factor, we usually just pass by, stop, and they'll talk about the history. When we get to 50th and San Pedro, which was Defense Committee House, where Andrew Davis, Jonathan Jackson, Mrs. Jackson, the mother of Jonathan George, and relatives of John Crochet and Frieda Drumgoole, where they would meet. We usually get out there and take a group picture. But because of the time factor, we can't get out everywhere. We come to Compton. We go to the two cemeteries that are across the street from one another on Central Avenue. And one of the cemeteries where Bunchy Carter and his brother Arthur Glenn are buried across the street is another cemetery. One of the comrades who was the head of the BSU at East LA College, Melvin X, where he's buried. So those, and we get out at those locations.
Okay. The other question I have, do you have a program, that sort of deal with educating young people? I know that you had said that one of the brothers had called a truce with regards to violence. And do y'all work, the Black August resistance movement, work with young people?
We encourage involving the young people in the work that we're doing to continue this tradition to pass on a torch. But some of the work that I've done, in particular, when I came home, one of the things I did was start an organization that's now dormant, was a Black Women's Community Development Organization that was specifically working with young people in the streets, young people coming out of prison. I've been involved with all the peace summits that took place in the 90s across the country, with the first one being in Kansas City, Missouri in 1993. So I'm part of the International Council for Urban Peace and Justice and Empowerment that works with young people across the country. Several comrades in different states who I've been involved with since that time period, and also with our brown brothers, particularly Nane Alejandres, who was the head of Santa Cruz Virus and Needles, George Galvez, who has an organization in Oakland area. So I continue to work network with those individuals, but Black August Los Angeles, I work specifically related to working one, liberate political prisoners, and also to engage a lot of young people. But in the streets right now, that's not something that we do with Black August Los Angeles.
All right. And let me just say this again. We want to thank you for your wealth of knowledge and information. In 1965 marked the day that I participated in the Watts Rebellion. So this is my 57th year of activism. And I just want to say how much we appreciate you on the program to explain what really the origins of Black August. We have so many dates and so many events in August that we recognize as a part of our struggle and martyrs that were assassinated or died or born in that month. And that's why we recognize it means so much. And then at the same time, Conrad World, as Pavanaugh was mentioning, he gave me my first book, Destruction of Black Civilization. When he came out here, I knew his father, I knew his niece and his aunt. That he's come out here for a family reunion. And Conrad World made a lot of the contribution. He became chairperson of the Black National Black United Front. And we deeply appreciate his contract as a professor at the University of Chicago and all the things that he did. And at the same time, Sister Dr. Medina, she's part of the Black clergy community and labor organization, which we meet general meeting every third Wednesday of the month. And she's on the board. So they meet every morning at 8 a.m. for the last 10 years building the Black United Front. The key to Black August is that we have so many events and so many things that young people don't know, and people that teach Black studies don't know, because they sort of gotten to more academics than community and cultural and resistance. And I'm glad you tied Black August recognition and commemoration to resistance movement. And we deeply appreciate you being a part of the show. And we're going to have you back, hopefully, because, you know, I was hoping that Brother Ayatollah Marvin Kinsey would come on. And I was hoping that Khalid Shah would come on, but neither one of them made it. But we're going to have them on. And we want to thank you, brother, for your wealth of knowledge. And you educated us about the inner operations of brutality and bestiality that happens to brothers that's behind the wall. And, it's like people forget about people. They think that everybody behind the wall did something wrong and they're not part of a political imprisonment and the COINTELPRO of countering our intelligence and demonizing and criminalizing our whole race and our young men and women.
Yes, sir.
Many of them did not even do anything and been held unjustly. We're talking about freeing the sister basketball player. But like Carrie said, we need to try to free all of the brothers and sisters that are in there that have done way more time than they were sentenced, and some of them shouldn't have done no time. So we deeply appreciate But as you know, it's an industrial complex. And the longer they keep you in, the more money they make. And that's what it is. Brother Rasha Key, you want to tell us what's happening Wednesday and close us out?
Okay. Am I unmuted? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so we got Kwabenat Sakidi, Jajaga Rasuli, and we're going to be talking about Marcus Garvey. And he's here, so he can tell us a little bit what we're going to talk about on Wednesday. Hey, Brother Kwabenat.
Yeah, Black August, you know, we recognizing Marcus Garvey, and he definitely, you know, talk about resistance and political prisoner. You know, one of the first ones that J. Edgar Hoover got. So we're going to deal with Brother Marcus Garvey on the anniversary of his birth, August 17th. And there's a specific quote that he talked about how propaganda has done damage to us that he talked about way back then. And we're going to also kind of like be a part two of this issue with this violent, vulgar propaganda that's being force-fed on the masses of our children and our youth, dumbing us down, making us apolitical. I'm going to deal with that. So looking forward to that on Wednesday.
I appreciate it.
Brother Dr. Shabaka out of New York, they've been having a petition to try to get Marcus Garvey commuted. We tried to get Obama to give him a full pardon before he left office, but he wouldn't do it. And so and he's from Chicago also, Obama. But we did our best with letters and a movement. Marcus Garvey is one of our heroes. His organization was infiltrated by the feds, and they deported him to Europe, he did much organizing. And as G2 was talking about Queen Mother Moore, she stayed at my house when we brought her out here to speak at Cal State Long Beach and North Cal State Northridge. And I still got some of the videos of Queen Mother Moore, who was one of the leaders of the Garveyites and the Black reparations movement. So I want to thank Brother G2 for raising her name up, because her and her sister Elizabeth, she always talked about. But go ahead, Rasha Key, close us out, and we're going to give, after you tell us about what's going on Wednesday, we're going to have G2 close us out with his last comments. Go ahead.
Okay, so like I said, we got Kwabenat coming on, and we're going to be talking about Marcus Garvey and some other subjects related to Black August. So, all right, Brother G2.
What I'd like to share in closing is that we really need to make, and I know this, everybody's probably doing it, to make a bigger push to get more of our young people involved in the struggle. To be aware, I was a guest speaker at Black Lives Matter's Los Angeles chapter's meeting last night. And that's one of the things I'm really impressed with, not only with Black Lives Matter, but also at Chico's Justice Center. They really put a lot of effort. Their focus is on young people. With Chuco's, they teach them policies, they educate them, they have a high school where they're educating these youngsters and to know policies and attack on that level, as well as with Black Lives Matter. It's not just going out there and protesting, it's learning the fundamentals of how this racist system works and how to dismantle it, you know, and so they're boots on the ground. And I've had a chance to work with some young people that I'm real impressed with. I got a couple of young brothers, young proteges that live in Iowa, of all places. And I talk to them regularly. Their uncle went through a program that I had in the 90s with BACDO, Black Women's Community Development Organization. And he was really impacted by that. And when he relocated to Iowa, he began to groom his nephews. And they're now, one just graduated from high school, one's in college, another's already in college. But just the work that I've done around the country with young people, that's our future. You know, and we really need to make them aware of what they need to do or pass that torch on. So those are the words I'd like to share in closing and pass the torch forward.
All right. We want to thank everyone for tuning in. This is Dr. Carrie Pratt, Linda Shorter, and Brother Kwame Sagidi, and all the other guests that we had that contributed to this program. And it was just as Rashiki said, just we learned so much, brother. It was like getting a master's degree in Black August, and we deeply appreciate it.
And, thank you, brother. It's my honor to be part of
it. We look forward to working with you. And as Carrie was saying, she wanted to get the information. You know, if you want your Facebook has a lot of information about how people can support you financially and support you with any kind of way that they can, as you ask.
That's my email. I use my regular name. So
okay,
please contact me. I'm from LA, born and raised, mostly in Vegas now, but you know, I'm there a lot because I still work there. So definitely want to connect. And I like what you just shared about the young people and how they're active. That's you're right. It's a different generation now. So, you know, just hoping that we can get some of these youngsters involved.
We already connected, sister. Your brother is my comrade.
Me
and him are being connected. So
okay.
Reach him through you. I mean, reach you through
Thank
him.
You. Thank you so much for sharing.
Okay. All right, everyone. I hope you can tune in Wednesday this movement about Marcus Garvey in recognition of his contribution to our forward flow of liberation. We want to thank everyone again, especially my dear sister Linda, for just keeping an eye out on guest speakers we should have on the show. And this was, we knocked it out the park tonight. Thank you very much, Linda.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Linda. Thank you for
coming. Good night. Peace, everybody.
Good night. Everybody stay safe.
Yes,
right. Teach wine and conscious corner.